those who live here. Aragon asked, You could use this technique to alter your body, couldn't you? Or is that too dangerous? Aramis's lips quirked in a faint smile. Alas, you have stumbled upon elves' greatest weakness, our vanity. We love beauty in all its forms, and we seek to represent that ideal in our appearance. That is why we are known as the fair folk. Every elf looks exactly as he or she wishes to. When elves learn the spells for growing and moulding living things, they often choose to modify their appearance to better reflect their personalities. A few elves have gone beyond mere aesthetic changes and altered their anatomy to adapt to various environments, as you will see during the Blood Oath celebration. Oftentimes, they are more animal than elf. However, transferring power to a living creature is different from transferring power to an inanimate object. Very few materials are suitable for storing energy. Most either allow it to dissipate or become so charged with force that when you touch the object, a bolt of lightning drives through you. The best materials we have found for this purpose are gemstones. Quartz, agates, and other lesser stones are not as efficient as, say, a diamond, but any gem will suffice. That is why riders' swords always have a jewel set in their pommels. It is also why your dwarf necklace, which is entirely metal, must sap your strength to fuel its spell, since it can hold no energy of its own. When not with Aramis, Aragon supplemented his education by reading the many scrolls the elf gave him, a habit he soon became addicted to. Aragon's rearing, limited as it was by Garrow's scant tutelage, had exposed him only to the knowledge needed to run a farm. The information he discovered on the miles of paper flooded into him like rain on parched desert, sating a previously unknown thirst. He devoured texts on geography, biology, anatomy, philosophy, and mathematics, as well as memoirs, biographies, and histories. More important than mere facts was his introduction to alternative ways of thinking. They challenged his beliefs and forced him to re-examine his assumptions about everything from the rights of an individual within society to what caused the sun to move across the sky. He noticed that a number of scrolls concerned Urgles and their culture. Aragon read them and made no mention of it, nor did Aramis broach the topic. From his studies, Aragon learned much about the elves, a subject that he avidly pursued, hoping that it would help him to better understand Arya. To his surprise, he discovered that the elves did not practice marriage, but rather took mates for however long they wanted, whether it be for a day or a century. Children were rare, and having a child was considered by the elves to be the ultimate vow of love. Aragon also learned that since their two races had first met, only a handful of elf-human couples had existed, mainly human riders who found appropriate mates among the elves. However, as best he could tell from the cryptic records, most such relationships ended in tragedy, either because the lovers were unable to relate to one another, or because the humans aged and died, while the elves escaped the ravages of time. In addition to non-fiction, Aramis presented Aragon with copies of the elves' greatest songs, poems, and epics, which captured Aragon's imagination, for the only stories he was familiar with were the ones Brom had recited in Carvajal. He savoured the epics as he might a well-cooked meal, lingering over the Deed of Gaeda or the Lay of Umhodan, so as to prolong his enjoyment of the tales. Saphira's own training proceeded apace. Linked as he was to her mind, Aragon got to watch as Gleda put her through an exercise regimen every bit as strenuous as his. She practiced hovering in the air while lifting boulders, as well as sprints, dives, and other acrobatics. To increase her endurance, Gleda had her breathe fire for hours upon a natural stone pillar in an attempt to melt it. At first, Saphira could only maintain the flames for a few minutes at a time. But before long, the blistering torch roared from her maw for over a half hour uninterrupted, heating the pillar white-hot. Aragon was also privy to the dragon lore Gleda imparted to Saphira, details about the dragon's lives and history that complemented her instinctual knowledge. Much of it was incomprehensible to Aragon, and he suspected that Saphira concealed even more from him, secrets of her race that dragons shared with no one but themselves. One thing he did glean, and that Saphira treasured, was the name of her sire, Irmungr, and her dam, Vervada, which meant storm cleaver in the old speech. While Jormungr had been bound to a rider, Vervada was a wild dragon who had laid many eggs, but entrusted only one to the riders, Saphira. Both dragons perished in the fall. Some days Eragon and Saphira would fly with Oromis and Gleda, practicing aerial combat or visiting crumbling ruins hidden within Duweldenvarden. Other days they would reverse the usual order of things, and Eragon would accompany Gleda while Saphira remained on the crags of Telnair with Oromis. Each morning Eragon sparred with Vanna, which without exception ignited one or more of Eragon's seizures. To make matters worse, the elf continued to treat Eragon with haughty condescension. He delivered oblique slights that on the surface never exceeded the bounds of politeness, and he refused to be drawn to anger no matter how Eragon needled him. Eragon hated him and his cool-mannered bearing. It seemed as if Vanna was insulting him with every movement, and Vanna's companions, who as best Eragon could tell were of a younger generation of elves, shared his veiled distaste for Eragon, though they never displayed aught but respect for Saphira. Their rivalry came to a head when, after defeating Eragon 6 times in a row, Vanna lowered his sword and said,
"Dead yet again, Shadeslayer. How repetitive. Do you wish to continue?"
His tone indicated that he thought it would be pointless.
"Aye,"
grunted Eragon. He had already suffered an episode with his back, and was in no mood to bandy words. Still, when Vanna said,
"Tell me, as I am curious, how did you kill Durza when you are so slow? I cannot fathom how you managed it."
Eragon felt compelled to reply, "I caught him by surprise."
"Forgive me, I should have guessed trickery was involved."
Eragon fought the impulse to grind his teeth. "If I were an elf or you a human, you would not be able to match my blade."
"Perhaps," said Vanna.
He assumed his ready position, and within the span of 3 seconds and 2 blows disarmed Eragon.
"But I think not. You should not boast to a better swordsman, else he may decide to punish your temerity."
Eragon's temper broke then, and he reached deep within himself and into the torrent of magic. He released the pent-up energy with one of the 12 minor words of binding, crying, "Malthinae!" to chain Vanna's legs and arms in place and hold his jaw shut so that he could not utter a counterspell. The elf's eyes bulged with outrage. Eragon said,
"And you should not boast to one who is more skilled in magic than you."
Vanna's dark eyebrows met. Without warning or a whisper of sound, an invisible force clouted Eragon on the chest and threw him 10 yards across the grass, where he landed upon his side, driving the wind from his lungs. The impact disrupted Eragon's control of the magic and freed Vanna.
"How did he do that?"
Advancing upon him, Vanna said,
"Your ignorance betrays you, human. You do not know whereof you speak. To think that you were chosen to succeed Vrail, that you were given his quarters, that you have had the honour to serve the Morning Sage."
He shook his head.
"It sickens me that such gifts are bestowed upon one so unworthy. You do not even understand what magic is or how it works."
Eragon's anger resurged like a crimson tide.
"What," he said, "have I ever done to wrong you? Why do you despise me so? Would you prefer it if no rider existed to oppose Galbatorix?"
"My opinions are of little consequence."
"I agree, but I would hear them."
"Listening, as Nuala wrote in Convocations, is the path to wisdom only when the result of a conscious decision, and not a void of perception."
"Straighten your tongue, Vanna, and give me an honest answer."
Vanna smiled coldly.
"As you command, O rider."
Drawing near so that only Aragorn could hear his soft voice, the elf said, "For 80 years after the fall of the riders, we held no hope of victory. We survived by hiding ourselves through deceit and magic, which is but a temporary measure. For eventually, Galbatorix will be strong enough to march upon us and sweep aside our defences. Then, long after we had resigned ourselves to our fate, Brom and Jode rescued Saphira's egg, and once again a chance existed to defeat the foul usurper. Imagine our joy and celebration! We knew that in order to withstand Galbatorix, the new rider had to be more powerful than any of his predecessors, more powerful than even Vrail. Yet how was our patience rewarded? With another human like Galbatorix, worse, a cripple. You doomed us all, Aragorn, the instant you touched Saphira's egg. Do not expect us to welcome your presence." Vanna touched his lips with his first and second finger, then sidestepped Aragorn and walked off the sparring field, leaving Aragorn rooted in place. "He's right," thought Aragorn. "I'm ill-suited for this task. Any of these elves, even Vanna, would make a better rider than me." Emanating outrage, Saphira broadened the contact between them.
"Do you think so little of my judgment, Aragorn? You forget that when I was in my egg, Arya exposed me to each and every one of these elves, as well as many of the Varden's children, and that I rejected them all. I wouldn't have chosen someone to be my rider unless they could help your race, mine, and the elves, for the three of us share an intertwined fate. You were the right person at the right place at the right time. Never forget that."
"If ever that were true," he said, "it was before Durza injured me. Now I see naught but darkness and evil in our future. I won't give up, but I despair that we may not prevail. Perhaps our task is not to overthrow Galbatorix, but to prepare the way for the next rider, chosen by the remaining eggs." At the crags of Telnair, Aragorn found Oromis at the table in his hut, painting a landscape with black ink along the bottom edge of a scroll he had finished writing. Aragorn bowed and knelt. "Master." 15 minutes elapsed before Oromis finished limning the tufts of needles on a gnarled juniper tree, laid aside his ink, cleaned his sable brush with water from a clay pot, and then addressed Aragorn, saying, "Why have you come so early?"
"I apologize for disturbing you, but Vanna abandoned our contest partway through, and I did not know what to do with myself."
"Why did Vanna leave, Aragorn Voda?"
Oromis folded his hands in his lap while Aragorn described the encounter, ending with,
"I should not have lost control, but I did, and I looked all the more foolish because of it. I have failed you, Master."
"You have," agreed Oromis. "Vanna may have goaded you, but that was no reason to respond in kind. You must keep a better hold over your emotions, Aragorn. It could cost you your life if you allow your temper to sway your judgment during battle. Also, such childish displays do nothing but vindicate those elves who are opposed to you. Our machinations are subtle and allow little room for such errors."
"I am sorry, Master. It won't happen again."
As Oromis seemed content to wait in his chair until the time when they normally performed the Rimgar, Aragorn seized the opportunity to ask, "How could Vanna have worked magic without speaking?"
"Did he? Perhaps another elf decided to assist him."
Aragorn shook his head. "During my first day in Ellesmira, I also saw Islanzadi summon a downpour of flowers by clapping her hands, nothing more. And Vanna said that I didn't understand how magic works. What did he mean?"
"Once again," said Oromis, resigned, "you grasp at knowledge that you are not prepared for. Yet, because of our circumstances, I cannot deny it to you. Only know this, that which you ask for was not taught to riders, and is not taught to our magicians, until they had, and have, mastered every other aspect of magic. For this is the secret to the true nature of magic and the ancient language. Those who know it may acquire great power, yes, but at a terrible risk. He paused for a moment. How is the ancient language bound to magic, Eragon Voda?
The words of the ancient language can release the energy stored within your body and thus activate a spell.
Ah, then you mean that certain sounds, certain vibrations in the air, somehow tap into this energy? Sounds that might be produced at random by any creature or thing?
Yes, Master.
Does not that seem absurd?
Confused, Eragon said, It doesn't matter if it seems absurd, Master. It just is. Should I think it absurd that the moon wanes and waxes, or that the seasons turn, or that birds fly south in the winter?
Of course not. But how could mere sound do so much? Can particular patterns of pitch and volume really trigger reactions that allow us to manipulate energy?
But they do.
Sound has no control over magic. Saying a word or phrase in this language is not what's important. It's thinking them in this language.
With a flick of his wrist, a golden flame appeared over Oremus's palm, then disappeared.
However, unless the need is dire, we still utter our spells out loud to prevent stray thoughts from disrupting them, which is a danger to even the most experienced magic user.
The implications staggered Eragon. He thought back to when he almost drowned under the waterfall of the lake Kustamirna, and how he had been unable to access magic because of the water surrounding him. If I had known this then, I could have saved myself, he thought. Master, he said, if sound does not affect magic, why then do thoughts?
Now Oremus smiled. Why indeed? I must point out that we ourselves are not the source of magic. Magic can exist on its own, independent of any spell, such as the Wheelites in the bogs by Arrows, the Dream Well in Mani's caves in the Beor Mountains, and the floating crystal on Eome. Wild magic such as this is treacherous, unpredictable, and often stronger than any we can cast. Eons ago, all magic was thus. To use it required nothing but the ability to sense magic with your mind, which every magician must possess, and the desire and strength to use it. Without the structure of the ancient language, magicians could not govern their talent, and as a result loosed many evils upon the land, killing thousands. Over time, they discovered that stating their intentions in their language helped them to order their thoughts and avoid costly errors. But it was no foolproof method. Eventually, an accident occurred so horrific that it almost destroyed every living being in the world. We know of the event from fragments of manuscripts that survived the era, but who or what cast the fatal spell is hidden from us. The manuscripts say that afterward a race called the Grey Folk, not elves, for we were young then, gathered their resources and wrought an enchantment, perhaps the greatest that was or ever shall be. Together, the Grey Folk changed the nature of magic itself. They made it so that their language, the ancient language, could control what a spell does, could actually limit the magic, so that if you said, "Burn that door," and by chance looked at me and thought of me, the magic would still burn the door, not me. And they gave the ancient language its two unique traits, the ability to prevent those who speak it from lying, and the ability to describe the true nature of things. How they did this remains a mystery. The manuscripts differ on what happened to the Grey Folk when they completed their work, but it seems that the enchantment drained them of their power, and left them but a shadow of themselves. They faded away, choosing to live in their cities until the stones crumbled to dust, or to take mates among the younger races, and so pass into darkness.
Then, said Eragon, it is still possible to use magic without the ancient language.
How do you think Saphira breathes fire? And by your own account, she used no word when she turned Brom's tomb to diamond, nor when she blessed the child in Fardandur.
Dragons' minds are different from ours. They need no protection from magic. They cannot use it consciously, aside from their fire. But when the gift touches them, their strength is unparalleled. You look troubled, Eragon. Why? Eragon stared down at his hands.
What does this mean for me, Master?
It means that you will continue to study the ancient language, for you can accomplish much with it that would be too complex or too dangerous otherwise. It means that if you are captured and gagged, you can still call upon magic to free yourself, as Vanna did. It means that if you are captured and drugged and cannot recall the ancient language, yes, even then, you may cast a spell, though only in the gravest circumstances. And it means that if you would cast a spell for that which has no name in the ancient language, you can. He paused. But beware the temptation to use these powers. Even the wisest among us hesitate to trifle with them, for fear of death, or worse. The next morning, and every morning thereafter, so long as he stayed in Ellesmere, Eragon duelled with Vanna, but he never lost his temper again, no matter what the elf did or said. Nor did Eragon feel like devoting energy to their rivalry. His back pained him more and more frequently, driving him to the limits of his endurance. The debilitating attacks sensitized him. Actions that previously had caused him no trouble could now leave him writhing on the ground. Even the Rimgar began to trigger the seizures as he advanced to more strenuous poses. It was not uncommon for him to suffer 3 or 4 such episodes in one day. Eragon's face grew haggard. He walked with a shuffle, his movements slow and careful, as he tried to preserve his strength. It became hard for him to think clearly or to pay attention to Oromus's lessons, and gaps began to appear in his memory that he could not account for. In his spare time, he took up Oryk's puzzle ring again, preferring to concentrate upon the baffling interlocked rings rather than his condition. When she was with him, Saphira insisted that he ride upon her back and did everything that she could to make him comfortable and to save him effort. One morning, as he clung to a spike on her neck, Eragon said, "I have a new name for pain."
"What's that?"
"The Obliterator. Because when you're in pain, nothing else can exist. Not thought, not emotion. Only the drive to escape the pain. When it's strong enough, the Obliterator strips us of everything that makes us who we are until we're reduced to creatures less than animals, creatures with a single desire and goal, escape."
"A good name, then."
"I'm falling apart, Saphira, like an old horse that's ploughed too many fields. Keep hold of me with your mind, or I may drift apart and forget who I am."
"I will never let go of you."
Soon afterward, Eragon fell victim to 3 bouts of agony while fighting Vanna, and then 2 more during the Rimgar. As he uncurled from the clenched ball he had rolled into, Oromis said,
"Again, Eragon, you must perfect your balance." Eragon shook his head and growled in an undertone,
"No."
He crossed his arms to hide his tremors.
"What?"
"No."
"Get up, Eragon, and try again."
"No, do the pose yourself, I won't."
Oromis knelt beside Eragon and placed a cool hand on his cheek. Holding it there, he gazed at Eragon with such kindness, Eragon understood the depth of the elf's compassion for him, and that if it were possible, Oromis would willingly assume Eragon's pain to relieve his suffering.
"Don't abandon hope," said Oromis, "never that."
A measure of strength seemed to flow from him to Eragon.
"We are the riders. We stand between the light and the dark, and keep the balance between the two. Ignorance, fear, hate, these are our enemies. Deny them with all your might, Eragon, or we will surely fail."
He stood and extended a hand toward Eragon.
"Now rise, Shadeslayer, and prove you can conquer the instincts of your flesh."
Eragon took a deep breath and pushed himself upright on one arm, wincing from the effort. He got his feet underneath himself, paused for a moment, then straightened to his full height and looked Oromis in the eye. The elf nodded with approval.
Aragorn remained silent until they finished the Rimgar and went to bathe in the stream, whereupon he said, "Master."
"Yes, Aragorn."
"Why must I endure this torture? You could use magic to give me the skills I need to shape my body as you do the trees and plants."
"I could, but if I did, you would not understand how you got the body you had, your own abilities, nor how to maintain them. No shortcuts exist for the path you walk, Aragorn."
Cold water rushed over the length of Aragorn's body as he lowered himself into the stream. He ducked his head under the surface, holding a rock so that he would not float away, and lay stretched out along the stream bed, feeling like an arrow flying through the water.
Narda.
Roran leaned on one knee and scratched his new beard as he looked down at Narda. The small town was dark and compact, like a crust of rye bread tamped into a crevasse along the coast. Beyond it, the wine-red sea glimmered with the last rays of the dying sunset. The water fascinated him. It was utterly different from the landscape he was accustomed to.
"We made it!"
Leaving the promontory, Roran walked back to his makeshift tent, enjoying deep breaths of the salty air. They had camped high in the foothills of the spine in order to avoid detection by anyone who might alert the Empire as to their whereabouts. As he strode among the clumps of villages huddled beneath the trees, Roran surveyed their condition with sorrow and anger. The trek from Palancar Valley had left people sick, battered, and exhausted, their faces gaunt from lack of food, their clothes tattered. Most everyone wore rags tied around their hands to ward off frostbite during the frigid mountain nights. Weeks of carrying heavy packs had bowed once proud shoulders. The worst sight was the children, thin and unnaturally still. "They deserve better," thought Roran. "I'd be in the clutches of the Razak right now if they hadn't protected me." Numerous people approached Roran, most of whom wanted nothing more than a touch on the shoulder or a word of comfort. Some offered him bits of food, which he refused, or, when they insisted, gave to someone else. Those who remained at a distance watched with round, pale eyes. He knew what they said about him, that he was mad, that spirits possessed him, that not even the Razak could defeat him in battle. Crossing the spine had been even harder than Roran expected. The only paths in the forest were game trails, which were too narrow, steep, and meandering for their group. As a result, the villagers were often forced to chop their way through the trees and underbrush, a painstaking task that everyone despised, not least because it made it easy for the Empire to track them. The one advantage to the situation was that the exercise restored Roran's injured shoulder to its previous level of strength, although he still had trouble lifting his arm at certain angles. Other hardships took their toll. A sudden storm trapped them on a bare pass high above the timberline. 3 people froze in the snow, Haida, Brenna, and Nesbit, all of whom were quite old. That night was the first time Roran was convinced that the entire village would die because they had followed him. Soon after, a boy broke his arm in a fall, and then Southwell drowned in a glacier stream. Wolves and bears preyed upon their livestock on a regular basis, ignoring the watchfires that the villagers lit once they were concealed from Palancar Valley and Galbatorix's hated soldiers. Hunger clung to them like a relentless parasite, gnawing at their bellies, devouring their strength, and sapping their will to continue. And yet they survived, displaying the same obstinacy and fortitude that kept their ancestors in Palancar Valley despite famine, war, and pestilence. The people of Carvajal might take an age and a half to reach a decision, but once they did, nothing could deter them from their course. Now that they had reached Narda, a sense of hope and accomplishment permeated the camp. No one knew what would happen next, but the fact that they had gotten so far gave them confidence. "We won't be safe until we leave the Empire," thought Roran, "and it's up to me to ensure that we aren't caught. I've become responsible for everyone here." A responsibility that he had embraced wholeheartedly, because it allowed him to both protect the villagers from Galbatorix and pursue his goal of rescuing Katrina. It's been so long since she was captured. How can she still be alive? He shuddered and pushed the thoughts away. True madness awaited him if he allowed himself to brood over Katrina's fate. At dawn, Roran, Horst, Baldur, Loring's three sons and Gertrude set out for Narda. They descended from the foothills to the town's main road, careful to stay hidden until they emerged onto the lane. Here in the lowlands, the air seemed thick to Roran. It felt as if he were trying to breathe underwater. Roran gripped the hammer at his belt as they approached Narda's gate. Two soldiers guarded the opening. They examined Roran's group with hard eyes, lingering on their ragged clothes, then lowered their poleaxes and barred the entrance.
"Where'd you be from?" asked the man on the right.
He could not have been older than 25, but his hair was already pure white. Swelling his chest, Horst crossed his arms and said,
"Roundabout Tirm, if it please you."
"What brings you here?"
"Trade. We were sent by shopkeepers who want to buy goods directly from Narda, instead of through the usual merchants."
"That's so, eh? What goods?"
When Horst faltered, Gertrude said, "Herbs and medicine on my part. The plants I've received from here have either been too old or mouldy and spoiled. I have to procure a fresh supply."
"And my brothers and I," said Darman, "came to bargain with your cobblers. Shoes made in the northern style are fashionable in Drasleona and Urubane."
He grimaced. "At least they were when we set out." Horst nodded with renewed confidence.
"Aye, and I'm here to collect a shipment of ironwork for my master."
"So you say." "What about that one? What does he do?"
asked the soldier, motioning toward Roran with his axe.
"Pottery,"
said Roran.
"Pottery?"
"Pottery.
Why the hammer, then?"
"How do you think the glaze on a bottle or jar gets cracked? It doesn't happen by itself, you know. You have to hit it."
Roran returned the white-haired man's stare of disbelief with a blank expression, daring him to challenge the statement. The soldier grunted and ran his gaze over them again.
"Be as that may, you don't look like tradesmen to me. Starved alley cats is more like it."
"We had difficulty on the road," said Gertrude.
"That I'd believe. If you came from Tirm, where be your horses?"
"We left them at our camp," supplied Hammond.
He pointed south, opposite, where the rest of the villages were actually hidden.
"Don't have the coin to stay in town, eh?"
With a scornful chuckle, the soldier raised his axe and gestured for his companion to do likewise.
"All right, you can pass, but don't cause trouble or you'll be off to the stocks, or worse."
Once through the gate, Horst pulled Roran to the side of the street and growled in his ear.
"That was a fool thing to do, making up something as ridiculous as that. Cracking the glaze. Do you want to fight?"
"We can't."
He stopped as Gertrude plucked at his sleeve.
"Look,"
murmured the healer. To the left of the entrance stood a 6-foot-wide message board with a narrow shingle roof to protect the yellowing parchment underneath. Half the board was devoted to official notices and proclamations. On the other half hung a block of posters displaying sketches of various criminals. Foremost among them was a drawing of Roran, without a beard. Startled, Roran glanced around to make sure that no one in the street was close enough to compare his face to the illustration, then devoted his attention to the poster. He had expected the Empire to pursue them, but it was still a shock to encounter proof of it. "Galbatorix must be expending an enormous amount of resources trying to catch us." When they were in the spine, it was easy to forget that the outside world existed. "I bet posters of me are nailed up throughout the Empire." He grinned, glad that he had stopped shaving, and that he and the others had agreed to use false names while in Narda. A reward was inked at the bottom of the poster. Garrow never taught Roran and Aragorn to read, but he did teach them their figures because, as he said,
"You have to know how much you own, what it's worth, and what you're paid for it, so you don't get rooked by some two-faced knave."
Thus, Roran could see that the Empire had offered 10,000 crowns for him, enough to live in comfort for several decades. In a perverse way, the size of the reward pleased him,
giving him a sense of importance. Then his gaze drifted to the next poster in line.
It was Eragon. Roran's gut clenched as if he had been struck, and for a few seconds he forgot to breathe. He's alive!
After his initial relief subsided, Roran felt his old anger about Eragon's role in Garrow's death and the destruction of their farm take its place, accompanied by a burning desire to know why the Empire was hunting Eragon.
It must have something to do with that blue stone and the Razak's first visit to Carvajal.
Once again, Roran wondered what kind of fiendish machinations he and the rest of Carvajal had become entangled in. Instead of a reward, Eragon's poster bore two lines of runes.
"What crime is he accused of?"
Roran asked Gertrude. The skin around Gertrude's eyes wrinkled as she squinted at the board.
"Treason, the both of you. It says Galbatorix will bestow an earldom on whoever captures Eragon, but that those who try should take care, because he's extremely dangerous."
Roran blinked with astonishment.
Eragon?
It seemed inconceivable, until Roran considered how he himself had changed in the past few weeks.
"The same blood runs in our veins. Who knows? Eragon may have accomplished as much or more than I have since he left."
In a low voice, Baldur said, "If killing Galbatorix's men and defying the Razak only earns you 10,000 crowns, large as that is, what makes you worth an earldom?"
"Buggering the king himself," suggested Larn.
"That's enough of that," said Horst.
"Guard your tongue better, Baldur, or we'll end up in irons. And Roran, don't draw attention to yourself again. With a reward like that, people are bound to be watching strangers for anyone who matches your description."
Running a hand through his hair, Horst pulled up his belt and said,
"Right, we all have jobs to do. Return here at noon to report on your progress."
With that, their party split into three. Darman, Larn and Hammond set out together to purchase food for the villagers, both to meet present needs and to sustain them through the next stage of their journey. Gertrude, as she had told the guard, went to replenish her stock of herbs, unguents and tinctures. And Roran, Horst and Baldur headed down the sloping street to the docks, where they hoped to charter a ship that could transport the villagers to Surda, or at the very least, Tirm. When they reached the weathered boardwalk that covered the beach, Roran halted and stared out at the ocean, which was grey from low clouds and dotted with whitecaps from erratic wind. He had never imagined that the horizon could be so perfectly flat. The hollow boom of water knocking against the piles beneath his feet made it feel as if he stood upon the surface of a huge drum. The odour of fish, fresh, gutted and rotting, overwhelmed every other smell. Glancing from Roran to Baldur, who was likewise entranced, Horst said,
"Quite a sight, isn't it?"
"Aye,"
said Roran.
"Makes you feel rather small, doesn't it?"
"Aye,"
said Baldur. Horst nodded.
"I remember when I first saw the ocean. It had a similar effect on me."
"When was that?" asked Roran. In addition to the flocks of seagulls whirling over the cove, he noticed an odd type of bird perched upon the piers. The animal had an ungainly body with a striped beak that it kept tucked against its breast like a pompous old man, a white head and neck and a sooty torso. One of the birds lifted its beak, revealing a leathery pouch underneath.
"Bartram, the smith who came before me," said Horst, "died when I was 15, a year before the end of my apprenticeship. I had to find a smith who was willing to finish another man's work, so I travelled to Siunon, which is built along the North Sea. There I met Kelton, a vile old man, but good at what he did. He agreed to teach me."
Horst laughed.
"By the time we were done, I wasn't sure if I should thank him or curse him."
"Thank him, I should think,"
said Baldur.
"You never would have married Mother otherwise."
Roran scowled as he studied the waterfront.
"There aren't many ships," he observed.
Two craft were berthed at the south end of the port, and a third at the opposite end, with nothing but fishing boats and dinghies in between. Of the southern pair, one had a broken mast. Roran had no experience with ships, but to him none of the vessels appeared large enough to carry almost 300 passengers. Going from one ship to the next, Roran, Horst and Baldur soon discovered that they were all otherwise engaged. It would take a month or more to repair the ship with a broken mast. The vessel beside it, the Wave Runner, was rigged with leather sails and was about to venture north to the treacherous islands where the Seether plant grew. And the Albatross, the last ship, had just arrived from distant Feinster and was getting its seams recorked before departing with its cargo of wool. A dock worker laughed at Horst's questions.
"You're too late and too early at the same time. Most of the spring ships came and left 2-3 weeks ago. And another month the nor'westers will start gusting, and then the seal and walrus hunters will return, and we'll get ships from Tirm and the rest of the Empire to take the hides, meat and oil. Then you might have a chance of hiring a captain with an empty hold. Meanwhile, we don't see much more traffic than this."
Desperate, Roran asked, "Is there no other way to get goods from here to Tirm? It doesn't have to be fast or comfortable."
"Well," said the man, hefting the box on his shoulder, "if it doesn't have to be fast and you're only going to Tirm, then you might try Clovis over there."
He pointed to a line of sheds that floated between two piers where boats could be stored.
"He owns some barges that he ships grain on in the fall. The rest of the year Clovis fishes for a living, like most everybody in Narda."
Then he frowned.
"What kind of goods do you have?" "The sheep have already been shorn, and no crops are in as of yet."
"This and that," said Horst.
He tossed the man a copper. The dock worker pocketed it with a wink and a nudge.
"Right you are, sir, this and that. I know a dodge when I see one. But no need to fear old Ulrich. Mum's the word it is. Be seeing you then, sir."
He strolled off, whistling. As it turned out, Clovis was absent from the docks. After getting directions, it took them a half hour to walk to his house on the other side of Narda, where they found Clovis planting iris bulbs along the path to his front door. He was a stout man with sunburned cheeks and a salt-and-pepper beard. An additional hour passed before they could convince the mariner that they really were interested in his barges, despite the season, and then trooped back to the sheds, which he unlocked to reveal three identical barges, the Mary Bell, Edeline, and Red Boar. Each barge was 75 feet long, 20 feet wide, and painted rust red. They had open holes that could be covered with tarpaulins, a mast that could be erected in the centre for a single square sail, and a block of above-deck cabins at the rear, or aft, as Clovis called it, of the craft.
"Their draught be deeper than that of an inland scow," explained Clovis, "so you needn't fear them capsizing in rough weather, though you'd do well to avoid being caught in a real tempest. These barges aren't meant for the open sea. They're meant to stay within sight of land. And now be the worst time to launch them. By my honour, we've had nothing but thunderstorms every afternoon for a month."
"Do you have crews for all three?" asked Roran.
"Well, no. See, there's a problem. Most of the men I employ left weeks ago to hunt seals, as they're wont to do. Since I need them only after the harvest, they're free to come and go as they please for the rest of the year. I'm sure you fine gentlemen understand my position."
Clovis tried to smile, then glanced between Roran, Horst and Baldur, as if uncertain whom to address. Roran walked the length of the Edeline, examining it for damage. The barge looked old, but the wood was sound and the paint was fresh. "If we replace the missing men in your crews, how much would it cost to go to Tirm with all three barges?"
"That depends," said Clovis. "The sailors earn 15 coppers per day, plus as much good food as they can eat, and a dram of whiskey besides. What your men earn be your own business. I won't put them on my payroll. Normally, we also hire guards for each barge, but they're off hunting, yes," said Roran. "We'll provide guards as well."
The knob in Clovis's tan throat jumped as he swallowed.
"That'd be more than reasonable, so it would. In addition to the crew's wages, I charge a fee of 200 crowns, plus recompense for any damage to the barges on account of your men, plus, as both owner and captain, 12% of the total profit from sale of the cargo.
Our trip will have no profit." That
more than anything, seemed to unnerve Clovis. He rubbed the dimple in his chin with his left thumb, began to talk twice, stopped, then finally said,
"If that be the case, another 400 crowns upon completion of the voyage. What, if I may make so bold as to inquire, do you wish to transport?"
"We frighten him," thought Roran.
"Livestock.
Be it sheep, cattle, horses, goats, oxen?"
"Our herds contain an assortment of animals."
"And why do you want to take them to Tirm?"
"We have our reasons."
Roran almost smiled at Clovis's confusion.
"Would you consider sailing past Tirm?"
"No, Tirm's my limit, it is. I don't know the waters beyond, nor would I want to be gone any longer from my wife and daughter."
"When could you be ready?"
Clovis hesitated and executed 2 little steps.
"Mayhap 5 or 6 days.
No, no, you'd better make it a week. I have affairs that I must attend to before departing."
"We'd pay an additional 10 crowns to leave day after tomorrow."
"I don't."
12 crowns.
"Day after tomorrow it is," vowed Clovis. "One way or another, I'll be ready by then."
Trailing his hand along the barge's gunwale, Roran nodded without looking back at Clovis and said,
"May I have a minute alone to confer with my associates?"
"As you wish, sir. I'll just go for a turn about the docks until you're done."
Clovis hurried to the door. Just as he exited the shed, he asked,
"I'm sorry, but what'd be your name again? I fear I missed it earlier, and my memory can be something dreadful."
"Stronghammer."
"My name is Stronghammer."
"Ah, of course.
A good name, that."
When the door closed, Horst and Baldur converged on Roran. Baldur said,
"We can't afford to hire him."
"We can't afford not to," replied Roran.
"We don't have the gold to buy the barges, nor do I fancy teaching myself to handle them when everyone's lives depend on it. It'll be faster and safer to pay for a crew."
"It's still too expensive," said Horst.
Roran drummed his fingers against the gunwale.
"We can pay Clovis's initial fee of 200 crowns. Once we reach Tirm, though, I suggest that we either steal the barges using the skills we learned during the trip, or incapacitate Clovis and his men until we can escape through other means. That way we avoid paying the extra 400 crowns, as well as the sailors' wages."
"I don't like cheating a man out of honest work," said Horst. "It goes against my fibre."
"I don't like it either, but can you think of an alternative?"
"How would you get everyone onto the barges?"
"Have them meet Clovis a league or so down the coast, out of sight of Narda."
Horst sighed.
"Very well, we'll do it, but it leaves a bad taste in my mouth. Call Clovis back in, Baldur, and we'll seal this pact."
That evening the villagers gathered around a small banked fire in order to hear what had transpired in Narda. From where he knelt on the ground, Roran stared at the pulsing coals while he listened to Gertrude and the 3 brothers describe their separate adventures. The news about Roran's and Aragorn's posters caused murmurs of unease among the audience. When Darman finished, Horst took his place, and with short, brisk sentences related the lack of proper ships in Narda, how the dockworker recommended Clovis, and the deal that was brokered thereafter. However, the moment Horst mentioned the word barges, the villagers' cries of ire and discontent blotted out his voice. Marching to the forefront of the group, Loring raised his arms for attention.
"Barges!" said the cobbler. "Barges! We don't want no stinking barges!"
He spat by his foot as people clamoured with agreement.
"Everyone be quiet," said Delwyn. "We'll be heard if we keep this up."
When the crackling fire was the loudest noise, he continued at a slower pace.
"I agree with Loring. Barges are unacceptable. They're slow and vulnerable, and we'd be crammed together with a complete lack of privacy and no shelter to speak of for who knows how long."
"Horst, Elaine is 6 months pregnant. You can't expect her and others who are sick and infirm to sit under the blazing sun for weeks on end."
"We can lash tarpaulins over the holes," replied Horst. "It's not much, but it'll shield us from the sun and the rain."
Birgit's voice cut through the crowd's low babble.
"I have another concern."
People moved aside as she walked to the fire.
What with the 200 crowns Clovis is due and the money Darman and his brothers spent, we've used up most of our coin. Unlike those in cities, our wealth lies not in gold, but in animals and property. Our property is gone, and few animals are left. Even if we turn pirate and steal these barges, how can we buy supplies at Tirm or passage further south?
The important thing, rumbled Horst, is to get to Tirm in the first place. Once we're there, then we can worry about what to do next. It's possible that we may have to resort to more drastic measures.
Loring's bony face crumpled into a mass of wrinkles.
Drastic? What do you mean, drastic? We've already done drastic. This whole venture is drastic. I don't care what you say. I won't use those confounded barges, not after what we've gone through in the spine. Barges are for grain and animals. What we want is a ship with cabins and bunks where we can sleep in comfort. Why not wait another week or so and see if a ship arrives that we can bargain passage on? Where's the harm in that, eh? Or why not?
He continued to rail for over 15 minutes, amassing a mountain of objections, before ceding to Thane and Ridley, who built upon his arguments. The conversation halted, as Roran unfolded his legs and rose to his full height, silencing the villagers through his presence. They waited, breathless, hoping for another of his visionary speeches.
"It's this or walk," he said.
Then he went to bed.
The Hammer Falls.
The moon floated high among the stars when Roran left the makeshift tent he shared with Baldur, padded to the edge of the camp, and replaced Olbrych on watch.
"Nothing to report," whispered Olbrych, then slipped off.
Roran strung his bow and planted 3 goose-feather arrows upright in the loam, within easy reach, then wrapped himself in a blanket and curled against the rock face to his left. His position afforded him a good view down and across the dark foothills. As was his habit, Roran divided the landscape into quadrants, examining each one for a full minute, always alert for the flash of movement or the hint of light that might betray the approach of enemies. His mind soon began to wander, drifting from subject to subject with the hazy logic of dreams, distracting him from his task. He bit the inside of his cheek to force himself to concentrate. Staying awake was difficult in such mild weather. Roran was just glad that he had escaped drawing lots for the 2 watches preceding dawn, because they gave you no opportunity to catch up on lost sleep afterward, and you felt tired for the rest of the day. A breath of wind ghosted past him, tickling his ear and making the skin on the back of his neck prickle with an apprehension of evil. The intrusive touch frightened Roran, obliterating everything but the conviction that he and the rest of the villagers were in mortal danger. He quaked as if with the ague. His heart pounded, and he had to struggle to resist the urge to break cover and flee.
"What's wrong with me?"
It required an effort for him to even knock an arrow. To the east, a shadow detached itself from the horizon. Visible only as a void among the stars, it drifted like a torn veil across the sky until it covered the moon, where it remained hovering. Illuminated from behind, Roran could see the translucent wings of one of the Razak's mounts. The black creature opened its beak and uttered a long, piercing shriek. Roran grimaced with pain at the cry's pitch and frequency. It stabbed at his eardrums, turned his blood to ice, and replaced hope and joy with despair. The ululation woke the entire forest. Birds and beasts for miles around exploded into a yammering chorus of panic, including, to Roran's alarm, what remained of the villagers' herds. Staggering from tree to tree, Roran returned to the camp, whispering,
"The Razak are here! Be quiet and stay where you are!"
to everyone he encountered. He saw the other sentries moving among the frightened villagers, spreading the same message. Fisk emerged from his tent with a spear in hand and roared,
"Are we under attack? What set off those blasted—"
Roran tackled the carpenter to silence him, uttering a muffled bellow as he landed on his right shoulder and pained his old injury.
"Razak!"
Roran groaned to Fisk. Fisk went still, and in an undertone asked,
"What should I do?" Help me to calm the animals.
Together they picked their way through the camp to the adjacent meadow, where the goats, sheep, donkeys and horses were bedded. The farmers, who owned the bulk of the herd, slept with their charges, and were already awake and working to soothe the beasts. Roran thanked his paranoia that he had insisted on having the animals scattered along the edge of the meadow, where the trees and brush helped to camouflage them from unfriendly eyes. As he tried to pacify a clump of sheep, Roran glanced up at the terrible black shadow that still obscured the moon like a giant bat. To his horror, it began to move toward their hiding place.
If that creature screams again, we're doomed.
By the time the Razak circled overhead, most of the animals had quieted, except for one donkey, who insisted upon loosing a grating hee-haw. Without hesitation, Roran dropped to one knee, fit arrow to string, and shot the ass between the ribs. His aim was true, and the animal dropped without a sound. He was too late, though. The braying had already alerted the Razak. The monster swung its head in the direction of the clearing and descended toward it with outstretched claws, preceded by its fetid stench.
Now the time has come to see if we can slay a nightmare, thought Roran.
Fisk, who was crouched beside him in the grass, hefted his spear, preparing to hurl it once the brute was in range. Just as Roran drew his bow, in an attempt to begin and end the battle with a well-placed shaft, he was distracted by a commotion in the forest. A mass of deer burst through the underbrush and stampeded across the meadow, ignoring villagers and livestock alike in their frantic desire to escape the Razak. For almost a minute the deer bounded past Roran, mincing the loam with their sharp hooves and catching the moonlight with their white-rimmed eyes. They came so close he heard the soft gasps of their laboured breathing. The multitude of deer must have hidden the villagers, because after one last circuit over the meadow, the winged monster turned to the south and glided further down the spine, melding into the night. Roran and his companions remained frozen in place, like hunted rabbits, afraid that the Razak's departure might be a ruse to flush them into the open, or that the creature's twin might be close behind. They waited for hours, tense and anxious, barely moving except to string a bow. When the moon was about to set, the Razak's bone-chilling shriek echoed far in the distance. Then nothing.
We were lucky, decided Roran when he woke the next morning, and we can't count on luck to save us the next time.
After the Razak's appearance, none of the villagers objected to travelling by barge. On the contrary, they were so eager to be off, many of them asked Roran if it was possible to set sail that day instead of the next.
I wish we could, he said, but too much has to be done.
Foregoing breakfast, he, Horst, and a group of other men hiked into Narda. Roran knew that he risked being recognized by accompanying them, but their mission was too important for him to neglect. Besides, he was confident that his current appearance was different enough from his portrait on the Empire's poster that no one would equate one with the other. They had no difficulty gaining entrance, as a different set of soldiers guarded the town gate, whereupon they went to the docks and delivered the 200 crowns to Clovis, who was busy overseeing a gang of men as they readied the barges for sea.
"Thank ye, Stronghammer,"
he said, tying the bag of coins to his belt.
"There be nothing like yellow gold to brighten a man's day."
He led them to a work-table and unrolled a chart of the waters surrounding Narda, complete with notations on the strength of various currents, locations of rocks, sandbars and other hazards, and decades' worth of sounding measurements. Drawing a line with his finger from Narda to a small cove directly south of it, Clovis said,
"Here's where we'll meet your livestock. The tides are gentle this time of year, but we still don't want to fight them and no bones about it, so we'll have to be on our way directly after the high tide."
"High tide?" said Roran. "Wouldn't it be easier to wait until low tide and let it carry us out?"
Clovis tapped his nose with a twinkle in his eye.
"Aye, it would. And so I've begun many a cruise. What I don't want, though, is to be slung up on the beach, loading your animals when the tide comes a-rushing back in and pushes us farther inland. There be no danger of that this way. But we'll have to move smart, so as we're not left high and dry when the waters recede. Assuming we do, the sea'll work for us, eh?"
Roran nodded. He trusted Clovis's experience. And how many men will you need to fill out your crews?
Well, I managed to dig up 7 lads, strong, true, and good seamen all.